listening nightly to our favorite shows. Radio, oh, why did you ever go? Oh, won't you please come back and entertain us? I long to turn the dial again to hear the past smile again. Radio, I miss you so.
Once again, it's time for Yesteryear. A look back at your favorite dramas, westerns, comedies, and musical variety shows from the golden age of radio. Here's your host for Yesteryear, Craig Roberts.
Time once again to settle into your favorite easy chair for another hour of Vintage Radio. Later on, a special tribute to the late radio producer Hyman Brown, creator of such popular radio dramas as The Adventures of the Thin Man, Dick Tracy, and Inner Sanctum Mysteries. Our salute coming up later on in today's program, but first, another salute to those in the United States military as we bring you Orson Welles' Almanac. Orson Welles, of course, was the celebrated wonder kid of radio going back to the 1930s during his portrayal of Lamont Cranston in The Shadow. And, of course, his meteoric rise to fame was particularly punctuated by the 1938 production of his Mercury Theater on the Air's rendition of H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds, a broadcast that to this very day is regarded as one of the highlights of the power of radio to move hearts and minds. This particular broadcast, Orson Welles' Almanac Special D-Day Presentation, was first broadcast on June 7th of 1944, just one day following the critical D-Day invasion of Europe, which ultimately led to the defeat of the Germans and the end of World War II in Europe. Return with us now to those exciting days of yesteryear with Orson Welles' Almanac, another classic radio moment from the archives of yesteryear.
Major Bowes, I miss the shadow nose, Fred Allen's alley folks, the laughter of Duffy's Tavern, Helen Trent, oh, then we went to Can You Top This? Suspense in the Whistler sent those shivers up our spines. Uncle Don, I wish that he was on. Jack Armstrong, Bert and Marge, Amos and Andy. I long to turn the dial again to hear the past smile again. Radio, I miss you. Sodio, vodio, dodio, do. Radio, I miss you so.
The following program will be interrupted to bring you any late news developments. Good evening. This is Orson Welles. Instead of our regular program at this time, the makers of Mobil Gas and Mobil Oil and the Mercury Theater bring you a special broadcast.
My dearest son, I guess June 6th and 7th will be always remembered in history. I know that none of us will ever forget those days, even we who live at home. Your father will have more to remember about these 2 days and more to tell you. I don't know where he is now as I write this. Somewhere in the north of France it must be. But when he comes back, and oh, my dear little son, I pray to God he will come back. When he comes back, I know he'll have a better story to tell than this. Anyway, here's our side of it, here on the home front. That's what the papers call it, the home front. Sometimes I feel kind of ashamed of that expression. It really isn't much of a front. We do have trouble getting houses, and there isn't much room on the streetcars. Sometimes the steak is a little tough, but there aren't any of us living on K rations, and altogether the war is pretty easy to fight here in sunny California. We work hard. Don't let anybody tell you we've let down, because we haven't. And we won't. And our work is important. But nobody out here sleeps in a bomb shelter. And for the last 2 days, everybody's started to realize that again. And I think that's part of the reason why the whole city's been so quiet ever since Monday night. You know, even the people out here who don't have anybody to worry about, even those people are telling themselves again how lucky they are. Sometimes Luck can be sort of embarrassing. We first heard the news at 12:35 a.m. I work on the P-38 center section assembly over at Lockheed, and I was having trouble fixing the air hose.
I just hope I can get Josie, that's all. She's the only one who knows how to do my hair. Hand me that, will you, please?
Why don't you go where I go, Lillian?
Well, I hate to change.
I tell you what, we'll meet for lunch tomorrow, and I'll take you. I used to have a lot of trouble. They always left it too flat at the sides. It made my face look too
Attention.
Hard.
Attention, everybody. We have just heard the following news on the radio. Under the command of General Eisenhower, Allied naval forces, supported by strong air forces, began landing Allied armies this morning on the northern coast of France.
That's funny. I've been waiting for this, and I don't know.
What do you mean?
I always thought it was going to be different. I thought maybe everybody would cheer.
It's too early to cheer.
Here is the text of the order of the day from General Dwight D. Eisenhower, announcing invasion of Europe. You are about to embark upon a great crusade. The eyes of the world are upon you, and the hopes and prayers of all liberty-loving peoples go with you. You go with superior arms, security from the air, and incontestable right on your side. Let us all observe a minute's silence for prayer.
My shift was over then. Lil and I walked to the parking lot together, neither one of us talking. Nobody around was talking much. I said goodnight to Lil. I wanted to get to a radio, and I don't have one in my little 39 Chevy. So I stopped off at Joe Fanati's. That's a greasy school not far away from Lockheed. A lot of the kids hang out there. Only I'd forgotten Mr. Fanati doesn't have a radio.
A radio?
Yes, I want to hear the
news. Why don't
you
give one of them? Who's going to play my jukebox?
Mr. Fanati,
You want to hear the news? I want to come to Rome yesterday. Good, huh?
All of the
Mr. Fanati, haven't you heard? The invasion started.
Oh, sure, I know.
Yes, the invasion. They just announced it.
All the time to make announcement yesterday. Invasion. The day before
no,
the telegraph.
That's a fake.
Sure, it's a fake. The day before telegraph girl.
Yeah,
she make a mistake,
girl.
Huh?
Sure, that's a mistake.
About an hour ago, some fella come in here, he said the German, he sent over news. That's a fake, too.
Yeah,
gonna be lots of that.
Now.
You watch, they don't go over till September.
September, you're crazy.
But Joe, we heard it at the plant. They made an announcement on the loudspeaker.
Did you hear that, Paul?
Yeah.
That right, lady?
Yes, it came over the loudspeaker at the plant.
What was that?
Yes. Well, I got a radio in my car. Let's go out and listen.
Hey, she's gonna play one.
I don't know. All I heard was that Allied troops landed on the northern coast.
Hey, mister, what about the eggs you ordered? Your eggs, mister?
You know, church,
hold it. We'll be back.
I still think it's a fake.
Well, come on, let's go find out.
I hope nobody steals their drink.
Oh, Wally, how you carry on.
Well, here it is. We'll get it in a minute.
I'm so for headaches caused by hyperacidity.
Oh, hey, what's going on?
Wait, it's the radio. It's about the invasion.
Effective civil administration of France.
I bet you sound good.
All presidents must continue in their present duties unless otherwise instructed.
Henry!
Those
General
who have
Eisenhower!
What?
It's General Eisenhower!
The country will be removed.
He should be.
As France is liberated from her oppressors, you yourself,
your
representatives, and the government under which you wish to live. In the course of this campaign, the final defeat of the enemy, you may sustain further loss and damage. Tragic though they may be, they are part of the price of victory. I assure you that I
invasion, all right.
will do all in my power to mitigate your hardship. I know that I can count on your steadfastness now. The heroic deeds of Frenchmen who have continued their struggle against their Nazi and their Vichy satellites.
All right, turn that thing down, will you please? Wake up the whole neighborhood.
Yeah, but officer,
you heard me. You got it on too loud.
Officer, it's the invasion.
What?
The invasion. They
can't
in.
Invasion. Quiet. Quiet.
In Western
Europe. I want to hear this.
Great battles lie ahead. I call upon all who love freedom to stand with us. Keep your faith staunch. Our arms are resolute. Together, we shall achieve victory.
We return you now to New York.
This is Bob Trout in the Columbia Navy.
Wait a minute.
You have just heard General Eisenhower.
Hey, mister, what about the eggs? They got nice clothes. What about the eggs?
While we're waiting for more bulletins, which are coming in now, here's an item from a South England embarkation port. An officer explaining to a private who asked where he was going said, "You're going to have a nice holiday by the sea. You won't have any KP or fatigue details or training or anything. Just relax."
Some relaxing.
Yeah.
We stood there in the middle of the street, a whole crowd of us standing around the car, all of us listening. After a while, I think a lot of us felt like getting home. I know I did. So then when the King of Norway went on the air and started speaking Norwegian, I went back over to my car and drove as fast as I could go to the apartment. Oh, it looked so strange. The apartment building, I mean. Everybody's lights were on all over the place. Even old Mrs. Borgeson, who's never up after 8. Her little dog was barking and Levinson's little baby was crying. And of course, everybody was playing their radios.
Hello, dear. You heard the news?
Good evening, Miss Borgeson. Yes. Yes, I've been listening.
It's wonderful, isn't it? Just wonderful.
You heard about it?
What's that, Mr. Levinson?
Airborne troops, they landed there. Thousands, he said, already in parachutes.
Mr. Levinson, I keep telling you, he said airborne. That's something different than paratroopers.
Look, like I'm telling you, airborne is paratroopers, paratroopers is airborne. It's all the same to me. What do you think they got? Maybe jet propulsion.
Look what we got now around here. Mr. Major George Fielding Elliott already.
Excuse me, what?
French. Yeah. Before that, they had on the fellow from Holland. But by me, the main news is the paratroopers. This looks to me very strategic.
Quentin Reynolds we got. So, Mr. Big Mouth, now you got up the baby already.
The baby is up, so leave him be up. A night like this is going to hurt him. Besides, we can't ask everybody to turn down their radio, so the baby is up all right.
Like I tell you, Mr. Levinson, if airborne troops and paratroopers were all the same, the man wouldn't talk about both of them.
Wait a minute. Who should know better? Ask Helen. Her husband is a paratrooper.
Max, sha-sha.
What's this sha-sha business? So what did I say? The lady's husband is a paratrooper? So
Max.
I would be... Oh. Excuse me. Excuse me. I didn't think.
Well, that's all right, Mr. Levinson.
We're not going to have time. We're going to switch you now to Allied correspondent Wright Bryant in London. Come in, London.
Hello, New York. Hello, New York. In the first hour of D-Day, the first spearhead of Allied forces for the liberation of Europe landed by parachute in northern France. In the navigator's dome in the flight deck of T-47, I rode across the English Channel with the first group of planes from troop carrier to command to take our fighting men into Europe. All day Monday, we watched the weather, and then, well, there was a tenseness in the air that nobody talked about. In the early evening, Major Richardson came into the enclosure. He stood for a moment watching the men in the small recreation area, and then he called them into the briefing room, and the pilots, co-pilots, navigators, and radio men clustered around the major in the briefing room. There was a large-scale map on the wall showing the course to be followed.
Men, I think this is it. All I want to know now is there anyone who doesn't know exactly what to do? Okay. Get your stuff and report to the operations room immediately. I'm going down to the colonel to get the weather report. You all want to get back, don't you?
You can say that again, sir.
Then, damn it, get in there and fight.
The crews piled into their trucks to go first to the operations office and then to the line where their planes were drawn up ready to go. As they moved toward the airport, the vast long columns of airborne troops appeared, trudging slowly under their full loads of battle equipment. General Eisenhower visited them during the afternoon, quietly passing among the men and chatting with them, asking their names about their homes and their jobs. Outside the door of each C-47, the soldiers assembled, checked their equipment. Ground crews and combat crews gave the planes a final tuning up. Heavily laden transport planes began taxiing along in the long procession toward the runway. The paratroopers adjusted their packs, donned their May Wests and chutes, and climbed into the planes. Each was so heavily loaded that he had to be pushed from behind and pulled from above to get up to the steps going into the plane. As the men settled in their bucket seats on the plane I was to fly in, Lieutenant Colonel Robert Cole, the commanding officer aboard, came up to them.
There's a doc coming over to give you some pills. That'll keep you from getting airsick.
Sure.
Make yourselves as comfortable as you can. Better try to sleep a little.
Thank you, sir.
I know one thing. My parachute's okay. My mother checked it.
His mother checked it.
No kidding. She works in the Pioneer Parachute Company in our town. And her job's giving the once-over to all the chutes that come out of there. Well, I'm okay.
Almost before we knew it, we were trundling past the operation buildings and the control tower, and then foot by foot, almost inch by inch, we began to rise above the fields and trees of southern England. All about us and below us was such a glimmering fabric of light as I had not seen in the 8 months I had been in blackout England. Four times we circled the field, its runways, perimeter, outlined in sparkling white light. Through the sky, formation lights of the planes strung almost to the limit of vision. Look, for all the world like holiday decorations. As the long procession straightened out and its pre-established course, signal lights blinked and navigators checked the speed and direction of the pilots, began their continuous plotting of position. We were right on course and 1 minute early. I went back to see how the paratroopers were riding. More than half of them had taken the colonel's advice and were dozing with their heads back against the wall and their feet stretched out in front of them. The rear door was open, and down below I saw more signal lights blink, and then we crossed the coast of England and pushed out over the channel. The sea was calm, and soon the moon brightened the water, made the ripples below us twinkle.
Hey, Tiny, tell the colonel it's 30 minutes till jump time.
Yeah.
I looked straight ahead, and I caught my first glimpse of the coast of France. Navigation had been perfect. We could see the beach ahead precisely at the point we'd studied it on the maps and aerial photographs. The moon was almost full. And as our strong ship crossed above the breakers into the air of France, we plunged into a bank of cloud or fog and lost sight of the plains around us. In a matter of 2 or 3 minutes, we were flying formation on instruments. Then we emerged into clear moonlight. The small fields looked peaceful with their orderly hedgerows. Now the paratroopers were on their feet, each adjusting his pack, snapping his ripcord over the static line. That's a cable which ran along the center of the cabin ceiling so that each chute would open automatically as each paratrooper jumped through the door.
Are you all set? Everybody got everything? Here, get this thing hooked for me, and let's get going.
That was Colonel Cole taking his place with his men. The jump lights, a small bank of signal lamps, were gleaming beside the door. They blinked, and then, before I could get ready to watch, the paratroopers started jumping. I wanted to know how long it would take the 18 men to jump. I tried to count. 101, 102, 103. To the estimate of number of seconds, you know. It may have been 11 or 12, but no more, and then our passengers were caught. All except one. They jumped so swiftly, one had been pushed against the door frame and was thrown back into the cabin so violently that he was dazed. The men behind him had shoved him aside and gone on. After a moment, he climbed to his feet and started for the door. Staff Sergeant Eberle stopped him.
I'm okay, Tiny. Let me go.
Easy, soldier. Pass the drop zone.
I don't care. I'll find him. I'll get back.
It's too late.
You gotta let me, Tiny. The guys will think I'm yellow. Please, Tiny, I'm all right, I tell you.
Relax, soldier. Nobody's gonna think you're yellow. You can't jump now. We'll be over the channel in a minute. Sit down and take it easy. You'll get another chance.
I went back to the front of the ship and looked out the glass dome. Tiny streams of tracer bullets were curling upward from the ground behind us. One of the pilots in our squadron had unwittingly left all of his formation lights on. The tracers came close to his wingtips, but we saw nothing that looked like heavy ack-ack, except in the far distance. We'd been over France only 11 minutes. Behind us, we could still see an occasional flare, and below, a few more ships, but we couldn't tell what they were. The Battle of Europe had begun.
and our squadron had delivered the first Allied soldiers to their scene of action.
This is Bright Bryant in London, returning you now to New York.
Yes? Come in.
Excuse me. I got here a little soup. I thought maybe you was hungry, huh?
Oh, thank you, Mrs. Levinson.
You've been listening?
Yeah.
We've been listening. Who hasn't? You know that one fellow, something went wrong, who didn't jump? You shouldn't worry too much. Maybe that fellow, he could be your husband, huh? Could be.
Oh, it wasn't his fault. He wanted to jump. I hope it wasn't my Ned.
You hope it wasn't?
Maybe I shouldn't say that. I know Ned wouldn't want that to be him. He'd want to get there first. That's why he's a paratrooper. Whoever it was, he wanted to jump. It wasn't his fault. He'll go the next time. Let's see what they're saying.
You don't know where the next blow may fall. Prepare yourself for all eventualities. Today, tomorrow, or at any time.
Before we knew it was daylight. Mrs. Levinson and Miss Jameson made coffee for us all and fixed a little breakfast.
Come on, honey. Have a little toast at least. Do you good.
Thanks, no, but I will have some more coffee.
Eat something, darling. Look how you look.
Yeah, I'm going to take a shower. I've got to get to work pretty soon.
Look, already they're 10 miles in.
Goodbye, everybody.
Goodbye, Mr. Harriman.
Already they're 10 miles in. Wait and see, Mama. It's going to be quicker than we thought.
Don't be so sure. They got into Italy all right. But after that, look how long it took. It's uneasy.
You never can tell what'll happen. One little thing goes wrong. Look at Dieppe.
But that was a different thing. That was 2 years ago. From this, we learned a lesson. Yeah. The way it turns out, the fellas that died there wasn't wasted.
I like what the king said. He said, the spirit of the people burned up like a bright flame. And he said, now is the time when we don't fight to keep the Nazis away, but to win the war. He said, everybody should pray. Keep on praying.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what he said.
And the queen said so, too. Of course, they said it better.
I tried to get a little sleep and... Then about 1 o'clock, I went over to Lillian's and we sat by her radio for a while. She phoned the beauty parlor and canceled our appointment. And then we got to talking and decided to go and sign up for nurse's aid. You can do that on a part-time basis. And then we went to work. There's going to be an announcement.
Attention, everybody. Attention, please. During this last shift, the president made a special broadcast. For the benefit of all of you who've been working and couldn't hear it, we're now going to read you his message. My fellow Americans, in this poignant hour, I ask you to join me in prayer. Almighty God, our Son, pride of our nation, this day has set upon a mighty endeavor, a struggle to preserve our republic, our religion, and our civilization, and to set free a suffering humanity. Prevail over the unholy forces of our enemy. Help us to conquer the impostors of greed and racial arrogances. Lead us to the saving of our country and with our sister nations into a world unity that will spell a sure peace. A peace invulnerable to the schemings of unworthy men, and a peace that will let all men live in freedom, reaping the just rewards of their honest toil. Thy will be done, Almighty God. Amen.
Lillian slept in my apartment Tuesday night. Of course, we didn't really sleep. We listened and read and read and listened. We heard today from our headquarters that we're making progress on the whole front. We heard all kinds of things. Rumors and facts and more rumors. Some things were important and some weren't, but I don't know. Somehow these last few days, everything seems important. One little story made a big impression on me for some reason. It was about a Brooklyn G.I. Joe in Rome. Papers didn't give his name. He got up on the balcony where Mussolini used to stand. We've all seen it in the newsreels. And then he made a speech like Mussolini used to make. Oh, it must have been funny. That Brooklyn boy making faces and shouting double talk and the crowd below him loving it. I got the idea. They'd heard double talk from that balcony before. Only now, this time they could laugh at it out loud. And speaking of double talk, the first official Japanese statement about the invasion was pretty funny, too, in its own peculiar Japanese way.
The anti-Axis landing operations on the European continent must be highly welcome to the Germans. We can well imagine the jubilation in the German high command on the receipt of the news of the invasion. Thank you.
And then this afternoon we heard from Switzerland that a large Allied fleet was seen off the French-Italian coast. That about takes it up to now. I'm going to put this letter away for you to read later on. Maybe your father will join in reading it when he comes back. And when you're old enough, my dearest little Robert, I think you'll like to know about these last 2 days. I know I haven't had anything special to say. I've been a long way off from where things have been happening. I've just been one of the millions and millions waiting at home and listening to the radio and reading all the papers. That's all. But I've tried to show you what it was like here and what we felt like and what we thought about. When you're old enough, little Robert, I hope you'll read very carefully the words of General Eisenhower. They'll probably teach them to you in school, but I'm putting them down here in this letter anyway.
Soldiers, sailors, and airmen of the Allied Expeditionary Force, you're about to embark upon the Great Crusade, toward which we have striven these many months. The eyes of the world are upon you. The hopes and prayers of liberty-loving peoples everywhere march with you. You'll bring about the destruction of the German war machine, the elimination of Nazi tyranny over the oppressed peoples of Europe, and security for ourselves in a free world. Your task will not be an easy one. Your enemy is well-trained, well-equipped, and battle-hardened. You'll fight savagely, but this is the year 1944. Much has happened since the Nazi triumphs of 1940-41. The United Nations have inflicted upon the Germans great defeat in open battle, man to man. Our air offensive has seriously reduced their strength in the air, their capacity to wage war on the ground. Our home fronts have given us overwhelming superiority in weapons and munitions of war, and placed at our disposal great reserves of trained fighting men. The tide has turned. The free men of the world are marching together to victory. I have full confidence in your courage, devotion to duty, and skill in battle. We'll accept nothing less than full victory. Good luck, and let us beseech of Almighty God his blessing upon this great and noble undertaking.
That was his order of the day. General Eisenhower's. They say it went to every man who had a part in the invasion. I guess maybe I shouldn't use that word. The president wants us to call it the liberation. I'm sure that's the way your father thinks of it. And now, my little Robert, this is the end of the first letter anybody ever wrote to you. It has to be ended now because your mother has a lot of work to do. A whole lot of planes to help build. And she hasn't got much more time for work. And even if by any chance your name shouldn't be Robert, if it should turn out to be Dorothy, I know you'll want to hear about these last 2 days. June 6th and 7th, 1944. Your loving mother.
Ladies and gentlemen, you've just heard Agnes Moorhead and the Mercury Theater in a special broadcast brought to you by the makers of Mobile Gas and Mobile Oil instead of our regular Wednesday night program. Please join us again next week. Till then, I remain, as always, obediently yours. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
From June 7th of 1944, it's been Orson Welles' Almanac with a special D-Day presentation. In a moment, Inner Sanctum Mysteries and a tribute to Hyman Brown as this edition of Yesteryear continues.
You're listening to listener-supported Swing Street Radio. Swing Street Radio, where the big bands swing. The sounds of the golden age of radio continue with Yesteryear.
Hyman Brown, who long before there was television, created immensely popular radio dramas like The Adventures of the Thin Man and Dick Tracy, employing an arsenal of beleaguering sound effects that terrified or tickled many show's listeners, recently passed away. Probably the most memorable of Hyman's work was The Inner Sanctum Mysteries, whose ominous opening of a creaking door and menacing farewell of pleasant dreams became signatures not just of the show, but of the heyday of radio itself. In 1974, when radio drama was all but extinct, Hyman Brown began a nightly series called CBS Radio Mystery Theater, which continued until 1982 and even revived That Creaking Door. In his prime, Brown in the 1930s and 40s was the jack of all trades, once estimating he produced or participated in more than 30,000 radio shows. Inner Sanctum was first heard on the Blue Network in January of 1941. The program featured wildly improbable stories, usually turning on the maddest happenstances. Tested literary devices were used shamelessly to fool listeners. The most frequent trick was the telling of the story from the viewpoint of the killer. Inner Sanctum moved to CBS in 1943, where it became a mainstay there, and Hyman Brown directed throughout the run. The final season concluded in October of 1942, after a summer run on CBS. Return with us now to those exciting days of yesteryear with Inner Sanctum Mysteries and Dead Man's Deal from August of 1945, another classic radio program from the audio vault of yesteryear.
Lipton Tea and Lipton Soup present Inner Sanctum Mysteries. Good evening, friends of the Inner Sanctum. This is your host. Welcome again through the squeaking door. Did you miss us? You know, we haven't been around to haunt you these last 8 weeks. Yes, that's right. Death takes a vacation. Where have we been? Oh, we spent our vacation in a nice, cool place. Underground. Of course, we missed your smiling faces, but where we went, everybody grinned. Yes, they couldn't help it. They were grinning skulls. Yes, and if you'd like to get acquainted with murder real soon, then listen to Dead Man's Deal.
It's an original radio play by that chill master, Emil Tepperman. And our star tonight is Larry Haynes, who plays the role of Joe Lester. It all happened to Joe Lester, who's really a small-time gambler and who had no business in that big-time game with Barney Flood and Dan Kilmer and Nick Zapparetti and the others. But it's really Lester's story. So here he is to tell it to you.
I guess it was the biggest poker game I ever took a hand in. It was in Barney Flood's room, number 327, the Brandon Hotel. They were all big shots. I had to play a careful game. I only had about $3,000, and if I didn't nurse it, a single deal could wipe me out.
What's the matter, Lester? Playing kind of tight, Alan Joe.
Whatever, Barney. Man's entitled to play his own game, isn't he?
Sure. Maybe you don't belong in this one. You need guts for this game. You tell him, Dan.
Maybe Lester doesn't know what guts are, Barney.
Now listen, you.
Don't try to get tough, Lester. It wouldn't be healthy.
Lester saw it, me, Dan. So because I took his girl away from him. How didn't you, Lester?
Suppose we leave Louise out of this, Barney. She prefers you, that's okay with me.
That's mighty big of you, Lester.
That's why I hated Barney Flood. He'd taken Louise away from me. And Louise was the only thing in the world I loved. And what was worse, Barney Flood and his man, Dan Kilmer, were laughing at me because they knew I didn't have the guts to do anything about it. But then it came. The hand I'd been waiting for. Dan Kilmer was dealing. Barney Flood opened blind.
I opened for 1,000.
I dropped.
That's me.
The others all dropped out. But when I picked up my 5 cards, I found I had 3 aces. This was the way I'd wanted it. Just Barney Flood and me. And me with a strong hand before the buy. Now I'd show him who had guts. I counted out $2,000 in $100 bills and shoved them out on the table. I see you, Barney. And raise your 1,000.
Oh. So our little Lester's waking up. Okay, I see the raise. Just the two of us, hmm?
How many cards, Barney?
1.
Right. And how many do you want, Big Shot?
I'll take 2.
Yeah.
My hands were a little clammy as I picked them up. I looked at the cards. And suddenly I felt as if I'd inherited the whole universe. I had bought an extra ace. I held 4 aces.
Well, Big Shot, I've bought something here. I think it's the winning hand. I'm going to bet the works. Here. All the cash I have with me. 90 grand.
90 grand.
I felt the sweat on my hands as I watched him push the money out on the table. 90 grand he was betting. And I had him beat with my 4 aces. But I couldn't see his bet. All I had was about $1,000.
Come on, Big Shot. What are you waiting for?
You know I haven't got that much money.
You shouldn't be playing in this game, Tin Horn.
You're taking advantage of me, Barney. You're trying to show me up. You know I have to drop out even with a better hand.
Oh, so you think you have a better hand, eh?
Make the bet inside my limit, and you'll see.
All right, Lester. We'll see what kind of a gambler you really are. Here, I'll withdraw this 90 grand bet. I'll make another kind of bet. A bet you can see. If you have the guts.
What kind of bet?
I'll bet my life against your life. The man who loses this deal agrees to commit suicide.
For a full minute after Barney Flood made his proposition, the room was so quiet you could hear a pin drop. Barney Flood and I sat facing each other across the table, our closed cards in our hands. These were the biggest stakes men had ever played for. A life against a life. The other players were stunned and frightened by it. They wanted no part of it. One by one, they made lame excuses and faded from the room.
Hi, Dan.
Only Dan Kilmer was left with Barney and me.
Look, Barney, why should you risk your life against this punk's life?
This is the way it's going to be, Dan. Lester hates me. Don't you, Lester?
Yes, Barney. I hate you.
You see, Dan, he hates me because deep down inside of him, he knows he isn't as good as I am. All right. This is the showdown. One of us walks out of this room alive. The loser stays here with a bullet in his brain. Is that okay with you, Lester?
Yeah. Yeah, sure, it's okay with me, but I don't want Dan in the room. This is just between you and me. Let him go out before we uncover our cards.
All right. Well, listen, Bart.
You heard him, Dan. Just the two of us.
Okay. Leave your gun here on the table, Dan.
I don't like...
Do as I say. Okay. Thanks. Now go down to the lobby and wait.
So long. I'll be waiting in the lobby.
Okay, Lester. There's no backing out now. We'll open our hands. The loser picks up that gun and blows his brains out.
This was the minute I'd been waiting for. My lips were dry. I wet them with my tongue. Now, at last, I had Barney Flood exactly where I wanted him. Okay, Barney. Read them and weep. How do you like these? One ace, two aces, three aces, four aces. How do you like them, Barney?
Four aces,
I kept my eyes on Barney. I wanted to milk the last drop of satisfaction out of that moment. But he was a born gambler. His face didn't show a thing. He sighed, and slowly he began to turn over his own cards. Three of hearts, four of hearts, five of hearts, six of hearts, seven of hearts. A straight flush.
Well, Lester, straight flush beats four of a kind.
You only bought one card.
That's right. I went in with three, four, five, and six of hearts. I bought the seven of hearts.
A straight flush, eh? I can't believe it. I've lost.
Yes, Lester. You've lost. You've lost your life. And a gambler always pays up. There's the gun, Lester. Go ahead. A gambler always pays up.
Curled my finger around the trigger. I stood up and leaned across the table. I pointed the gun at Barney Flood and I shot him in the head. Now I had to work fast and carefully. I had it all figured out. When I shot Barney, I leaned over the table so the barrel of the gun was close to his head. There were powder burns on his temple around the wound. I wiped my fingerprints off the gun and pressed Barney's hand around the barrel. Next, I turned my attention to the card table. This was important. I left my four aces intact where I laid them out. But I changed Barney's hand slightly. I removed the seven of hearts, replaced it in a deck. In Riffle's doodle, I found the seven of diamonds. I substituted this for the seven of hearts. Now Barney's hand was no longer a straight flush. It was an ordinary straight. And my four aces were better. So now it looked as if I had won the game. I was ready. I picked up the phone and asked the operator to connect me with the police. Hello? Police headquarters. This is Joe Lester. I'm in room 327 at the Brandon Hotel. Barney Flood has just committed suicide.
Well, it looks as if Lester has carefully set the stage for foul play. He has to be careful if he wants people to believe that Barney has committed suicide. Because that's the last thing in the world a man would do. And now, let's go back to Joe Lester. Let's see if his airtight scheme to make Barney Flood's murder look like suicide goes over with the police. Yes, and let's hope it's not so airtight that it leaves him dangling in air at the end of a hangman's noose.
At headquarters, all the players told the same story. How Barney Flood had proposed a suicide bet and how they'd all cleared out. Inspector Larkin dismissed them all, leaving only Dan Kilmer and myself in the office with him and the stenographer.
Now, you, Kilmer.
Yes, Inspector.
You're Barney Flood's right-hand man?
Well, you know I have a private detective's license. Barney paid me to be his bodyguard.
You worked for Barney a long time?
That's right.
Mister says you left your gun on the table. Is that right?
That's right.
Then I went out.
Okay, Lester. It's your story from here. What happened after Kilmer went out?
Well, Barney and I uncovered our hands. He had a small straight, but I had four aces. You saw the cards lying there on the table?
Yeah, I saw them. What happened then?
Well, Barney said, well, I guess I lose. He picked up the gun. I tried to stop him, but he said a gambler always pays up. And he put the gun to his head to pull the trigger before I could stop him.
Hmm. What do you think of that story, Kilmer?
I think he lies.
Makes you think so?
I can't say.
Ah, that's no evidence. Looks like suicide. I'm afraid there's no charge told, John Lester. I wish there was.
You mean I'm free to go?
Yeah, sure. Go on. Get out.
Dan Kilmer gave me a dirty look, but I only grinned at him. I got up and went to the door. Everything was going my way. I was rid of Barney Flood. I'd committed the perfect murder. And now I was free to go to Louise.
You know, it's awful funny.
Hmm? What's awful funny, Louise?
How Barney killed himself. Here's your drink.
Oh, thanks. There's nothing funny about it. He lost and he paid off.
Yeah, I know, but somehow I can't imagine Barney losing a hand like that.
Now, listen, Louise, you stop thinking about Barney. He's dead, seeing I'm alive, and I'm not letting any other man have you. Is that plain?
Yes, darling, it's plain.
Come here, baby. That's better. You know, I'm crazy about you.
You seem to have changed. You seem so strong.
Yeah, you bet. From now on, nothing stops me. You know what? We're getting married tomorrow. We won't wait.
I better answer the phone.
I'll let it ring.
No, you better let me answer it.
Well, okay, go ahead, but make it snappy, will you?
I will, darling. Hello? Yes, this is Plaza 87790.
I watched her at the phone. And she was more beautiful than anything I'd ever known. That was the happiest I'll ever be. That one short moment while I watched her at the phone. And then it was over.
Yes? Yes, he's here, but who is this? What are you talking about? No. No, it can't be. Please. Please, I...
Her voice trailed off into a sob and she came up. She looked as if all her life had been drained out of her body by that phone call. Louise, who was that? Who was that on the phone? What did he say?
He said to remind you about the seven of hearts. He said you know what he meant.
Seven of hearts. The card I'd substituted in Barney Flood's hand. But no one could know about the seven of hearts. Barney was the only one. And he was dead. Who gave you that message, Louise? Who was that on the phone?
He didn't give his name, but I recognized the voice.
Louise, for heaven's sakes, tell me who it was.
I can't believe it, but I'd swear it was Barney Flood.
And then the phone rang again.
It's the phone again. He's calling back.
I'll answer it. Pushed Louise roughly aside. Slowly, I walked toward the ringing phone, almost in a daze, and picked it up. I think I must have been expecting it, because I wasn't surprised when I heard that voice. I only felt numb.
Hello, Lester. I'm waiting for you. Outside the house, across the street. Won't you come out and talk to me about the Seven of Hearts?
Seven of Hearts. He wanted to talk to me about the Seven of Hearts. He was waiting outside. But who? I dropped the phone and went to the window, pulled back the blind and peered out. At first I saw nothing. And then I spotted him. A shadowy figure standing in a doorway across the street with his hat brim pulled low over his face. And just then a car swept down the street. Its headlights illuminated the doorway and I got a quick look at the face. There was blood dripping from under the hat brim. I remember how I managed to get out of Louise's apartment. Not the front way. I didn't dare go out into the street with that shadowy figure waiting out there. I stumbled blindly down the back stairs, flight after flight, almost tripping, skinning my hands on the banisters, bruising my elbows, but I didn't care. I wanted to get away from there.
Taxi, mister?
What?
Taxi, mister.
Taxi. A taxi. Yeah, sure. Get going, quick.
Sure, but where to?
Where to? I didn't care. Anywhere. Anywhere, as long as it was away from here. Home. Home, that was the place. I'd go home and shut myself up and not answer the phone. 17 Glidden Road. Quick.
Right.
I heaved a sigh of relief as we pulled away. Out of pure instinct, I suppose, I looked out the rear window. Suddenly, the blood began to pound in my head like a thunderous avalanche. Because back there at the corner was that same shadowy figure, getting into another cab, pointing after my taxi. Faster, faster, driver. You gotta go faster.
Hey, what's wrong, mister?
Look, that cab behind us. $20 if you lose it.
What cab?
That one, you fool. The cab behind us.
Hey, one of us must be nuts. Maybe you had a couple too many. There isn't any cab behind us.
I turned around and looked again. My driver was right. The street was empty as far back as I could see.
Here you are, mister. 17 Glidden Road.
I got out of the cab and saw that the driver was looking at me as if he thought I was drunk or crazy. My shirt was wet with perspiration. My head began to throb and everything swam before my eyes. Then a voice began to whisper in my ear like a terrible refrain.
Seven of hearts. Seven of hearts. Seven of hearts.
I leaned weakly against the taxi cab.
Seven of hearts.
Slowness, I looked down the street.
Seven of hearts. Seven of hearts.
Same shadowy figure with a hat that was pulled low over the bloody face.
Seven of hearts.
Walking toward me.
Seven of hearts. Seven of hearts.
And now faster. Coming toward me faster. And the refrain ringing in my ears. I couldn't
seven
stand it. I flung myself into
seven
the cab.
Hearts.
I wanted safety.
Seven
Action.
Of hearts.
Drive the police. That's
seven of
fast.
Hearts.
Police headquarters. I burst into Inspector Larkin's office. He was in there talking to Dan Kilmer.
What's your idea of barging in here, Lester?
I got to talk to you, Inspector.
What's wrong, big shot? You look all broken
you
up.
You keep out of this, Dan. I've come to see the inspector.
What do you want?
I want protection. You got to protect me.
Protect against whom?
Against Barney Flood. He's come back.
Is he gag?
No, it's no gag.
The guy's gone nuts.
No, I tell you, Barney Flood's come back. At first, I thought it was a phony, but now I'm sure it's Barney Flood.
How do you know it's Barney Flood?
Because... I stopped short. I'd almost said too much. I couldn't tell him about the Seven of Hearts. I couldn't tell him why I was sure it couldn't be anybody else but Barney Flood.
Get out of here, Lester. I've got no time to waste.
But you've got to assign an officer to protect me. I'm afraid to go home.
Look, Lester, I think you're going nuts the way Dan says. If I assign an officer to you, everybody'd say I was going nuts, too. Signing a cop to protect a man against a ghost.
But I insist.
Get out!
Look, Dan, will you help me?
What? Oh, me?
What, you're not working now, are you?
No, I lost my job when Barney died.
Well, look, how about a job? Working for me. Protecting me, huh?
Against a ghost? Against Barney Flood's ghost?
Oh, what do you care as long as I pay you?
Okay, Lester. You've hired me.
Good. Come on, then. Come home with me. I want you to sit up with me all night, huh? Dan Kilmer came home with me. And we sat up, whiling the time away, playing two-handed poker.
My dear Lester.
Yeah, sure.
So you're really scared, huh, Lester?
Don't laugh at me, Dan. You'd be scared, too, if you'd seen what I saw.
You mean, like the guy with the blood on his face?
How'd you know about that?
And the telephone call about the Seven of Hearts?
The Seven of...
I figured that stuff would sort of get you on edge.
What do you mean?
I mean that I'm the one that planted that man outside Louise's apartment. That was me on the telephone.
You?
Sure. That cab driver was my man, too. I had him planted out in back of Louise's house. He was waiting for you to come out the back way. You see, Lester, I had you figured right. Every move.
You did all that? What was the idea?
I wanted to get you right here. Like this. Afraid of your own shadow.
What for?
Pick them up.
Picked up the cards.
I stared at them. It was four aces. The same hand I'd held with Barney Flood.
How would you like to make a little bet on your hand, Lester? Against mine. Say, your life against my life.
What do you mean?
Don't you get it yet? Here, I'll turn my cards over for you. See? Three of hearts, four of hearts, five of hearts, six of hearts, and the seven of hearts. You see, Lester, my hand does have the seven of hearts in it. So did Barney Flood's. Before you took it out.
How do you know about the seven of hearts? For a long time, Dan Kilmer didn't say anything. He just sat there, looking at me. Then he got up, took out his gun, laid it on the table. Then he went to the door.
How did I know about the seven of hearts? You see, Lester, I dealt the other hand, too.
Barney Flood was right. A gambler must always pay up. The gun is ready on the table. And now, I'm ready, too.
He's in a very grave situation now. Yeah, so grave, he needs the help of an undertaker. But he was only a beginner in crime. He might have done better if he hadn't come to such an untimely end. And now a word of advice. You can't afford to gamble with death because the loser never gets a chance to stage a comeback. And what's more, friends, if all the corpses on this program were laid end to end, they'd be a lot more comfortable. Next week's story is going to blow the tubes in your radio. It's about a beautiful woman who marries a dead man. Now there's an unusual romance. And this graveyard Romeo has second sight and always knows who's going to be murdered next. Well, of course he's got second sight. He lost his first sight when he died. See? Now it's time to close the squeaking door until next Tuesday. So, good night. Pleasant dreams.
From August of 1945, it's been Inner Sanctum Mysteries with Dead Man's Deal. And a special tribute to late producer Hyman Brown. Well, I'm afraid that's all the time we have today, but be with us again next week and invite a friend to listen to more great moments from the golden age of radio. I'm Craig Roberts with those fabulous days of yesteryear. Till next time, so long.
Radio, remember radio. We'd sit and close our eyes and use our listening nightly to our favorite shows, radio. I miss you, sodio, volio, dodio, do, radio. I miss you so.
The preceding program, copyright Edgewater Productions, all rights reserved. KSSR-DB San Francisco, where the big band swings.